session number 11286, reel 1.
Mr. Robinson, reel 1.
Can you tell me, first of all, about what you remember about what kind of a ship Hardy was to live on and to work on?
Well, to begin with, it was a destroyer of the H-class. They were one of nine in the flotilla. And we operated... she was a lovely ship to work with. It was more or less very... Better to live on a small ship than on a big ship. Everybody knew everybody else. And so on. When the war started, we were in Malta in the Grand Harbour on Sunday morning, September the 3rd, 1939. War broke out, and we proceeded from Malta. We went to Greece. There was a civil war on in Greece, and we picked up about 150 refugees, took them from Greece to Gibraltar. We dropped them off at Gibraltar, and instead of turning to starboard to come home, we turned to port and went down to West Africa. We were down in Freetown, West Africa, operating off the coast of West Africa, till the December.
What kind of work was Hardy doing then?
Just patrolling around a certain area, what they called Freetown Patrol. We used to go to sea for 3 weeks and call into Freetown for the weekend. We came home then. We spent Christmas at sea, off Freetown, and we came home about the second week of January 1940. We had about 7 days leave each watch, and we proceeded to Scapa Flow. We stayed in Scapa Flow for a couple of weeks, and then we put to sea, and we were at sea for about 6 weeks, up to April the 8th, when the Glowworm got sunk by the Sharnost. The survivors of the Sharnost, I beg your pardon, the survivors of the Glowworm actually were picked up by the Sharnost, or the Neishinoah, I mean, we wasn't quite sure. We went to Dawn Action Stations then at 3:45 in the morning on the 9th, when we came into contact with the Sharnost and Neishinoah. Fortunately for us, we were in company with the Renown, the battle cruiser. A running battle ensued where the Renown scored two hits on one of the ships, and they scored a hit on the Renown. Our captain, Captain Warburton Lee, he wanted to go in at about 30 knots and fire torpedoes at them. But the Admiral on the Renown wouldn't have any of that. So anyway, there was a running battle, and they made their escape in a snowstorm.
What do you remember in detail about it?
I was up in the 4.7 director, just above the bridge, and the signal came, enemy in sight, bearing red 2-0, which is 20 degrees off the port bow. And the Renown opened fire with a 15-inch, and the reply came back about 4 minutes afterwards from them two. And we were about a quarter mile astern of the Renown, so they were on the port side, so all their rights were coming splashing around by us. That's 11-inch and 8-inch. They had already sunk the Glowworm. They had already sunk the Glowworm. On the morning of the 9th, I beg your pardon, at noon on the 9th of April 1940, we lay outside the entrance of Narvik Harbour, Narvik Fjord, and a Norwegian man, woman and boy came aboard, who I think were manning some sort of lightship. They came aboard and told us that there were only about 5 German destroyers had gone up Narvik Fjord the day before. Of course, the Admiralty, Churchill sent a signal to Warburton Lee, use your own prerogative. And the answer he got back from Corbin Lee was, I am going in. We went into Narvik Field at 11 p.m. on the 9th. And we arrived up in Narvik Field, where all the German destroyers were, some were alongside, some were anchored. We arrived there about 3:45 in the morning. We opened fire. That's the Hardy, Hunter, Hotspur, Hyperion and Havoc. We went in line astern, and we opened fire at 3:45 in the morning. They were firing a point-blank range. Some of the Germans were passing down 300 or 400 yards. We were firing a point-blank range at us. I had a good view of this. I was up in the director above the bridge. And we were swimming for our life at 6:45. They had a direct hit on the bridge. The captain was wiped out. There was about 7 wiped out on the bridge. Gunnery officer, there was no sign of the gunnery officer. All there was were a pair of sea boots. The captain had some terrible wounds in his side. He died as we lowered him in the water. Several signalmen was there. He got killed. The navigator died later on from his wounds. They had a direct hit on the TS, the transmitting station below the bridge. They had a direct hit on number 1 gun, number 2 gun, and number 4 gun. One of our men had the CGM, Conspicuous Gallantry Medal. He loaded, trained, and fired the gun for 20 minutes by himself, all the crew wiped out. His name is Douglas Borton from Newport. He had the Conspicuous Gallantry Medal for that. We abandoned ship. The order was given to abandon ship. The ship was grounded. About 110 shells hit us altogether, all calibers. And we were grounded, and the order was abandon ship. So we got down off the bridge into the Port Whaler, and that was so badly damaged it sunk straight away. We then got picked up by a few Carly floats that they capsized, so we swam ashore about 500 yards. I lay down on the beach. When I got on the sand, I couldn't get up. We were perished with the cold. Of course, it was subarctic. Eventually, the Norwegians came running down and picked us up, took us in the house of a lady called Mrs. Christiansen. She's 90 years of age now. She wants boys to go back and see her, I understand. We were in the house about 4 hours, and a chap came running in. A chap named Jenkins from Cornwall came running in, and he said to the lieutenant in charge, the Germans are 3 miles away, they're coming after us. And being as this man was a bit of a buzz spreader, in other words, he said things that shouldn't have been said, a rumour monger. The torpedo officer who was in charge turned around and said, Jenkins, if you were telling lies, I'll shoot you. He said, no, sir, I'm telling the truth. The Germans are around the corner. They're coming after us. It's just been broadcast through the village. So we got out of bed, and the order was every man for himself, walk up the field about 15 miles in the snow, in the blizzard, and you'll find there's a place called Ballangen. You will be received there by these people who are very hospitable. We got out of bed, barely anything on at all. I can't remember wearing any clothes at all because they were so cold, so they had to be cut off me. We walked 15 miles up the field, knocking each other about to keep warm. When we got to Ballangen, I was about half a mile from Ballangen. I was staggering about. I didn't know where I was. And staggering about, and a Norwegian came out of the house, picked me up over on his back, carried me in the house and put me in a bath, an empty bath, covered me with snow, and they gradually warmed the snow up, and I thawed out. So they gave me a suit to wear, a sheeing suit. And I sat down, and they asked me where I come from. Was I German or was I English? Deutsch? Whatever. I said, give me a pencil and paper and I'll draw it for you. I drew a map of the British Isles and put a dot where Port Talbot was. And he exclaimed, Celtic. I said, yes, Welsh. So I had a bit of a smile about that. And after they had given me coffee and cakes, I followed the rest of the boys who were trudging up, and we helped the wounded. And we went on for another quarter of a mile to half a mile, and we came to the actual village of Belangen, where the 150 civilian suits were smacked in a classroom, and the rest of the survivors picked their suits and got dressed again. We stayed there for a while, then we went up top of the mountain. And there was a phosphate mine up top of the mountain, so we were down there by day and up at night for exercise. And on the morning of the 13th, on the Saturday morning, the 13th of April, we were up top ready to go back down out of sight again, because the Germans are looking for us everywhere. And who should come around the corner, about 2.5 miles away, but the the Warspite and all the tribal class destroyers. They came around the corner and they opened fire, and the Warspite actually was firing over our heads, because we could hear the shells going over our heads whirring away into the distance. We saw one of the tribal class destroyers with his bows blown off. We thought that it was the RAF, but it turned out to be the Luftwaffe. And it was the Eskimo. It turned out to be the Eskimo. She had her bows blown off from the bridge. And several more went down. We stayed up top of the mountains after the battle. Then at midnight, on the 14th of April, as the day after the second battle in Narvik, we had our orders to file down in single file down to the jetty from the top. And who should be at the jetty but the ship called the Ivanhoe, one of the I-class destroyers. We went aboard the Ivanhoe, and we had a corned beef sandwich about an inch thick and a cup of Pusser's Kai, that's Navy cocoa, where you can stand a spoon up in that. And nothing felt so delicious, and all it's the most delicious cup of cocoa and the most delicious sandwich I ever had, because the 4 days we were in the village, all we had was a cup of tea or a cup of milk and a little slice of bread and a little bit of fish for 3 to 4 days. We went aboard the Ivanhoe, went out, and we steamed out at midnight to the entrance of the fjord, which was about 60 miles, and we started going home. We started proceeding in a southwesterly direction, which would have been towards Scapa Flow. And the Hero came alongside, one of our H boats who had not been interfered. And the orders were that 50 of us had to jump across from the Ivanhoe to the Hero. So I stood on the guardrails, hanging onto a davit, and waiting for the ship to come up, so that I could jump at the proper time. And as I jumped, a lieutenant commander had a camera, and he was whirring away with the camera, and I nearly jumped on top of him. We stayed aboard there then. We came home to Greenock, I think it was, in Scotland. And we proceeded into Denver Barracks, and we had 21 days survivor's leave. As it turned out, this lieutenant commander who had the camera turned out to be a war correspondent. And I went on 21 day survivor's leave, but before I went on survivor's leave, they showed the newsreel of the first battle of Narvik in the cinema, the Gorman British News. My mother and father had received a telegram in the meantime saying that, I mean, no doubt, that your son is believed lost or killed in action. My father wouldn't believe it. And they were in the cinema 3 or 4 days afterwards, and who should be jumping across from one ship to the other but me? And my brother and sister happened to be in the cinema, and they shouted out, "Look, is the Stan." So they all went all around the village, "He's alive, he's alive." And
which village was that?
Blaengwynfi, up in the valleys. Well, we stayed on the Hero for a while, incidentally, but we were transferred then to a liner called the Franconia. Franconia. And we were told to do watches aboard there. We had to do lookout watches aboard there. And we came home to Greenock and eventually finished up in Denbrook Barracks. And they dealt with us as sharply as they could. And they dished us out with old uniforms just to go and leave with. But when I went ashore in Devonport, we changed out of that back into our Norwegian civilian suits. Unfortunately, when we got to 4 Street in Devonport, we didn't recognise the place because it was all bombed, all flat. But I was with Douglas Bolton, and we came home together to Newport. And, of course, the Battle of Narvik was on everybody's lips then, and we were chatting to this old lady, an old gent, in this hostel where we stopped for the night. In the meantime, I sent a telegram, telling them when you expect me home. So I got on the way the following morning. I got home about 11 o'clock, 11 in the, four, in the forenoon. And I was greeted in the station in Blaengwynfi by a big silver band playing Rule Britannia and all that sort of thing. I was hoisted shoulder high and carried a mile and a half from one end of the village to the other. And I arrived home roughly about May the 7th. We were at sea about 3 weeks after the battle before we got home. But I arrived home about May the 7th.
What did you think about the performance which the German ships put up in the
terrific. Terrific. They thought at first it was an air raid because they were firing their pom-poms up in the air. The German destroyers were firing their pom-poms way over our masthead. But it wasn't very long before they had a few. They were hitting us. The Germans' technique of gunnery was superb. They'd fire over, they'd fire under, and then they'd hit. They always hit with a third salvo. And it wasn't long before they were hitting us right, left, and centre.
What about your own job in the Battle of Narvik? How did that go?
I was in the 4.7 director. I was the trainer of the 4.7 director.
Did you have any problems in the battle?
No, I didn't have any problems. No problems. I kept on. I was responsible for keeping on the target from left to right or port to starboard. And then the man on the other side for elevation, depression and elevation. The Germans were firing from the they were firing point blank range, two destroyers were from 300 yards away, and that's when they had some direct terrible hits on us, especially on the bridge. So we couldn't get out. The order was abandon ship. We had already grounded then, so we couldn't get out the starboard side. So we had to get out the port side because all the firing came from the starboard side. So I got out the port side. Then we all we had to do then clamber over the bridge down into the port whaler, which, as I said before, was so badly damaged it sunk straight away, went down straight away.
How frightening was it in the battle?
Terrifying. Terrifying. And the average age of the crew was only about, mind you, the average of the crew was only about 24. I think the youngest man aboard was about 19, and the oldest was the captain. He was 42 at that time. Warburton Lee was 42. And he eventually won the first VC of the War posthumous.
Did you see anything of the captain or the officers in the battle?
Our officers? No. There was the captain, the gunnery officer, and the navigator was on the bridge. The commander, E, engines. He was down in the engine room, of course. And they had the, they all had their own dispositions, you know.
And what did you think of the treatment that you received from the Norwegian civilians?
Oh, wonderful. Wonderful people. When I got ashore and got into the Mrs. Christiansen's house, all I can remember is standing up in my uniform and somebody cutting my uniform off me with scissors, which, of course, my uniform was frozen stiff. And then I was in bed then, in a single bed, with another boy off the ship who had already had one lot of this lot when he went down on the Courageous previously. And we were shivering so much with shock, cold, and terror. We were in the water about half an hour, you see. We were shivering so much that we were knocking each other out of bed. Actually knocking each other out of bed. It's only a single bed. But we had 4 hours of that, and we were watching the ship blow up through the windows, watching the ammunition lockers go up and all that sort of thing. Then, as I said, the shop came running in and said the Germans are after us, so it was every man for himself. I cut my life belt in half and put it on my feet, one on each foot. Little rubber life belts we used to have. And I can't remember wearing clothes, but Douglas Bolton and I knocked each other about all the way and kept warm that way. In the blizzard.
Is Douglas Bolton still alive?
Yes, last I heard of Doug, he was commanding officer with the Seagulls in Newport.
Do you think the Norwegian civilians would have given just as good treatment if it had have been German?
Yes, they treated the German fellows just the same as they treated us. They rigged up a school for a hospital, and our wounded and the German wounded were in the same place, in the same school. They were put in the same place. And I've always had the greatest respect for German sailors, because I drank with German sailors before the war. And I drank with them after the war, 1946, at Cuxhaven in Germany. I found them very nice fellas.
So there wasn't ill feeling at that
There was
point.
No ill feeling. I mean, they had a cause and we had a cause. And, I mean, they prayed to the same God as we did when they were at sea, morning prayers.
Now, can we go on to the Newcastle, because you had a long period of service on that.
Yes, I was on the Newcastle 3 years and 3 months.
How did you come to join it?
I was in Devonport Barracks, and I joined the Newcastle in Plymouth Sound on the 2nd of October 1940, when she was ACAC ship in Plymouth Sound. I stayed aboard there then till the 21st of December 43.
You mean it was protecting Plymouth from the air?
Yes, it was protecting out in Plymouth Sound, you see, from the aircraft, German aircraft.
Can you tell me what you remember of the Blitz on Plymouth?
When the Blitz happened in Plymouth, it was May 1941, where we were down the South Atlantic, and we had about 30 or 40 people on board, I'm sure. I must have came from Plymouth, because there were telegrams coming all the time about their families wiped out and this, that and the other. Some terrible things happened, you know. Plymouth was nearly wiped out.
But when you were there, anchored in Plymouth,
there was nothing there then. No, it was too early, actually. It was October 1940. There were air raids. There were air raids. I was in Plymouth during the time of Dunkirk. And the Germans are coming over and dropping their rubbish, you know. But it hadn't. But the worst they ever had was May 41, and we missed that. We were down the South Atlantic then.
How did you like serving on the Newcastle as compared with the Hardy?
Well, the Hardy was a happy little ship, but the Newcastle was a happy ship too. But there's a difference there. See, there was only 175 of us on the Hardy. There was 950 on the Newcastle. Bigger ship and more strict. Because the bigger ships were stricter than the small ships. She was a happy ship.
Which did you prefer, strict discipline or relaxed discipline?
Oh, no, I preferred the strict discipline. I was brought up that way from the time I joined the boys' training ship till I came outside. I prefer the strict discipline. It was relaxed on the hardy, but a good feeling, bonhomie and all that sort of thing, and everybody knew everybody else. But I was aboard the Newcastle 3 years and 3 months, and I got to know nearly everybody on there. And as I say, they were both happy ships.
Why do you prefer stricter discipline on a ship than more relaxed discipline?
Well, I preferred it because that's the way it was in the boys' training ship. We even marched to the toilet in the boys' training ship. You marched to do your washing. You marched everywhere. As you know, familiarity breeds contempt. But mind you, the strictness was there as far as the officers were concerned. But they weren't so strict as the officers are on the big ships. The small ships were a little bit more relaxed, but you still had to stick to the rules and regulations.
So, after you left Plymouth, what kind of duties did the Newcastle take up?
We left Plymouth Sound one night at 11 o'clock at night, and we proceeded with a ship called the Revenge, one of the old R battleships, to Boulogne in France. And we were 6-inch starshell decoy. We fired 6-inch starshell decoy, and the Revenge poured 15-inch into Boulogne. We did that stint, got back to Plymouth. On one occasion, we chased 5 German destroyers in the English Channel, chased them back to Brest. That was another separate incident. Then, in the new year, then...
When you fired on Boulogne, was there any incoming fire?
No, nothing at all. Nothing at all. We were fired. We were lying about 3 miles, 4 miles at sea, and we fired 6-inch starshell decoy, and the Revenge just poured 15-inch into the place.
When was that?
November 1940.
And what was this incident where you were chasing these enemy ships in the Channel? Was it in the Channel?
In the Channel, yes. They come into the English Channel. We chased them out and chased them to Brest. It was a forward action. We were firing the A and B turrets all the way back, all the way across. I don't think we had one hit on them. They were going so fast we couldn't catch them.
These were destroyers, were they?
German destroyers, yes. 5 German destroyers. We chased them back into Brest. So that was one little incident again.
When was that?
That was around about the end of 1940. Sometime the end of 1940.
What do you remember after that incident?
We went back to Plymouth. We were in Plymouth for a while. And then we proceeded then to the South Atlantic. We were down the South Atlantic from the May to the September. We went to a place then called Boston in the United States for a refit, where we stayed for 11 weeks. I came home for Christmas 41.
So in 41 you didn't really see very much action?
We didn't see any action in 41. Only one incident, very, very important really. There was a German ship carrying gold bullion and something else, I forget what it was, lying in the port of Rio de Janeiro. Now, being as it was in a neutral port, they're allowed 24-hour start when they leave in the morning. So they left at 6 o'clock in the morning and made their way across the Atlantic. And we left at 6 o'clock